The futures of many species on our planet depend on the actions of humans, but to get humans to act, one first has to make them care. Today, two individuals who are using their talents to inspire people to care. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ian Nichols is a photographer for National Geographic. I'll talk with him about capturing images of lowland gorillas, chimpanzees, and other creatures and sharing those images with the world. Then later in the hour, Margaret Wertheim and her twin sister came up with a surprising way to communicate about the plight of the world's coral reefs that goes beyond words or pictures. Together, they launched the Crochet Coral Reef Project. I'll talk with her. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with two people who are using their talents and skills to share messages about conservation with the world. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Margaret Wertheim, co-creator of the Crochet Coral Reef Project. But first, Ian Nichols is a photographer for National Geographic and a conservationist. He'll be speaking Thursday night in Des Moines at 6 p.m. as part of the Blank Park Zoo's Change Makers speaker series, and he is with me now. Hello, Ian.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start with you had a fairly unusual childhood growing up and traveling around the world. What took your family around the world?
So my father is Nick Nichols, and he's a photographer for National Geographic, too. He's got, most people know his photos. The most recent ones were big tree photos that he took in California of the redwoods. And so I got to grow up in that life. And so I got to travel when he would travel. Sometimes I stayed at home. Sometimes I went with him. But that let me go to Rwanda when I was six. And I wasn't able to see the mountain gorillas when I went. But being able to just kind of travel and live in that life and being in nature like that was certainly very important for growing up.
What did your dad teach you, or maybe this is something you just learned through observation, about the power of an image, the power it has to communicate with people?
Yeah, I've thankfully through my college years, he was working more in Africa, and that's kind of when he switched to more, he had started journalism and he went more conservation. And so I was able to spend 7 months in Gabon in a national park there. The whole family were there. And in that, I was able to see that the government, all these parks were created just because of photography, the work of my father and Mike Fay, a scientist. And so it was as stark as it can get to see that, you know, these photos, they showed them to the government officials, and then they saw what they had in their country and were excited about it and wanted to create national parks. And that, along with the science, to kind of give more depth to how large the parks should be and where they should be, really made a huge difference in Gabon and created a national park system.
When did you really find your own voice as a photographer? What was the work that set you on this path?
Oddly enough, it was that trip, because I was in college during the time and majoring in government, because I thought the best or the most effective way to do conservation work would be in the government. But that's not really my personality. And so on that trip, I was helping a researcher collect data on trash on the beach. And through that, I started taking photos just to better document the science. And from that, it just kind of went from there, because my whole life I've been around art and around my father who takes photos. And so it was always in me, but I never wanted to pursue it just because we never want to do what our parents do, because
right. That's,
you know, how we are. But it just basically went from there. I always had a camera with me in college after that and ever since.
Do you remember one of the early images that really got you hooked and made you want more?
I think, well, growing up, I was just surrounded by great photos and art. And there's always this poster I had around that, of a gorilla laying on the floor from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a painting. And I've always remembered that in my head. And then once I started taking photos, I think the first photo I really remember where I was like, oh, wow, okay, I nailed it, was that same trip. And I worked on a whale boat for part of the time with humpback whale researchers. And so they would need a photo of the tail or the top fin, dorsal fin, for ID purposes. And so I would take photos. And a lot of times when we're out, the whales would start breaching, which is they'd jump out of the water and fall down. And sometimes they would do it like 5 times in a row. And it's really spectacular to see. And I got a couple of photos of that made me realize, oh, I've got a talent that I should definitely pursue.
It must have been so exciting.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Especially just being out on a boat on the ocean and then, because there are a lot, I didn't realize how smart the humpback whales were. I mean, a lot of times they were just aware of what we were and curious of what we were as we were watching them.
Did you resist? Since you found this talent, you enjoyed taking photographs, you had these opportunities to take photographs that a lot of us can only dream of. But was there even further resistance after that because you didn't want to do what your dad did?
I think it was not as much resistance as we both knew that we are different people. And so my photography path is going to be different. And because I started it with science, in the sense of trying to be a better scientist. I mean, as I continue, it seems like science is always going to be a strong part of it, and certainly conservation, because that's been my goal from the start.
I want to talk about the time you spent in Congo taking photographs of lowland gorillas. You mentioned the mountain gorillas in Rwanda that you didn't get to see, and lowland gorillas are their cousins. And you spent a couple of months there, but you went to a place where there were researchers that were studying this group of gorillas, right?
Yeah, correct. They were a habituated group. So the researchers spent, I think, around 10 years following the apes and getting them used to human presence until they would tolerate people being around all the time.
So you could get fairly close.
Yeah, it was 7 meters. And so that way we were close enough for the scientists to get all their research, but then also far away enough that we weren't spreading diseases, because things like the common cold and tuberculosis, they can wipe out gorillas.
And we've talked about mountain gorillas on Talk of Iowa in the past. This is a group of gorillas that are terribly endangered. I spoke with a veterinarian who went to Iowa State University and actually does veterinary work in the wild to try to keep mountain gorillas alive. Are lowland gorillas in a similar circumstance? Are they as endangered?
They're not nearly as endangered. But they are. They do have threats, just like mountain gorillas. They're interesting in the sense that they really like dense forests full of vegetation. And with a lot of the logging that's going on, that creates kind of prime gorilla habitat. And so you see a lot of numbers, higher gorilla numbers in those areas that have been logged and things like that. But then with the human presence of farms and villages, like there's definitely conflict there. And so they're endangered, but not like mountain gorillas that have such a low population.
With the time that you spent photographing these lowland gorillas, as we just talked about, researchers had spent many years following this group of gorillas around and understood the family dynamic. They'd given the gorillas names, and you, the result of your time there was a photographic essay, but along with that, a really beautiful article written by Mark Jenkins that describes the family life that you documented in the 2 months that you were there. How did you learn about the gorillas? What was your process like?
Yeah, it's, I think, so with my process of taking photos, it's really just observation and kind of watching and understanding an individual or a group. And so I came into it without really any preconceptions. I thought maybe the silverback might be a little bit of a bully, just because that's usually how things work, but it wasn't that way at all. It actually surprised me a lot, just how it works, their family works out, but then it makes perfect sense once you think about it. So the silverback is the guardian of the group, and he has like 1 to 5 females with him, and then their offspring. And so he provides protection for the females and his offspring. But then at the same time, he's the one that has to figure out their kind of daily routine of where they go in the forest. And so that's maybe to the swamp or certain fruiting trees that he knows are close to fruiting. And so there's a whole lot of information that has to go in, you know, his daily routine. And then that's on top of keeping track of a group. And you kind of start to feel for him, because it is a situation where it's like herding cats. I mean, you have a lot of individuals and they're all going to do their own thing. And he's trying to keep track of everyone because there's leopard predation. That's really the main danger, because the elephants or chimps they're not going to kill a gorilla or anything like that. But so just seeing his role within the group, and the fact that the mothers provide a lot of care in the beginning, but then once their child is kind of old enough to take care of themselves, they just leave it with the silverback, and then they can forage farther for the food they want. And these are things that you can't really know until you spend a lot of time with them, but it really made me see that the role of that family group in evolution, how important it is for a species like gorillas.
You also were able to document interactions between the female gorillas, and so you have the silverback, but you have these females who, I guess in human terms, we'd call sister wives or something like that. But there's such a complex social structure there as well.
Yeah, that was something I wish I could have gotten into more, but because they were more independent from the group. And so Kingo, the silverback, was always with the group. But depending on like when I was there, it was the females that I saw the most of were the two that had infants at the time. And the two that had older children or no children were spread out farther, and I didn't see them as much.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Ian Nichols. He's a photographer for National Geographic and a conservationist. He'll be speaking Thursday night in Des Moines as part of the Blank Park Zoo Changemakers Speaker Series. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Margaret Wertheim. She is one of the co-creators of a unique project, the Crochet Coral Reef Project. I'll talk with her about that project that really has taken on a life of its own over the years. With me right now is Ian Nichols. He's a photographer for National Geographic and a conservationist. He'll be part of Blank Park Zoo's Changemakers Speaker Series. He'll be speaking Thursday night in Des Moines at 6 p.m. And Ian, before the break, we were talking about the 2 months that you spent photographing lowland gorillas in the Congo. And the result was a beautiful article in National Geographic back in 2008. I get the sense that this was a pretty life-changing experience for you. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I guess for me, I've always, since I was a child, been interested in science and conservation. But I'd never, in terms of school, I never really embraced it in that sense. And that's, you know, you don't have much zoology or kind of beyond cell science in school with biology. At least I didn't have it in school and then undergrad in college. And so it gave me a chance to live in a wilderness in the forest for nearly 4 or 5 years. And that just being around nature every day, you know, waking up to it and going to bed to it, and not having an escape from things like the bugs and the heat, and being in a place that was a really intact ecosystem. That's probably the biggest thing about it. And being around primates. And then living in a research camp where you have people discussing science all day and thinking about the world they're living in. And so that really kind of opened my eyes back into a world that I was always interested in, but I'd kind of been pushed away from in school. And so that was, I mean, it was great because I just, even this, well, the smallest things are always some of the best things to look at. So all the mushrooms and insects, it was just great to see the amount of diversity, and then seeing within the insects all the mimicry going on between the ants and the spiders, and just the army of ants that would just swarm the forest and eat everything. It was a great experience.
In sending your pictures out into the world, what are you hoping to communicate to people?
I went back to school to be a better communicator, just these kind of ideas. I really want people to be reminded of our connection to nature and that we're a part of nature and that we can't really, we're animals too. And, you know, we're certainly elevated above, you know, what we think of cows and things like that, but we're still under the same, you know, the pressures of the environment and all these same things. And I really want people to kind of remember that, and that connection is so strong. I think it's certainly for me, and it's so important in my life, and certainly for saving parts of the planet and things like lowland gorillas and mountain gorillas. You have to make people care, and I guess that's a simple way to put it: make people care more about nature.
You have gone back to school pursuing your master's. You're hoping to pursue a PhD to do research yourself. Does it feel like pictures are not enough?
Oh, no. I think it's partly because what I've been doing is also research. I think I actually visited the Great Ape Trust in Iowa, Great Ape Trust there, I think of maybe 6 years ago. And talked to Rob Shoemaker, and he was joking because I was showing him his photos, and he said, well, you've got, you know, a PhD right here. Like, the photos are data in a way. And for me, it's kind of trying to bring those two worlds together, because they go together. It's observation. And in a way that's more powerful, because there is the rules of the scientific world, and it's much, you know, it's much looser being an artist. And so knowing all that history behind the science is very helpful for me to make better photos.
So you're hoping to be able to bring both the art and the science together.
Yeah. And then to use those with conservation to kind of have each one of those supports each other. And so you end up with a very strong, well, whatever you're working on is going to be much more powerful because of that.
And what is your dream? What do you hope to work on once you're able to bring both of these sides together?
Since after that work in Congo, I've been wanting to go visit as many chimpanzee sites as I can, because each site, the groups of chimps, have a culture that's tied to the environment and even how they've their history. And so I really want to be able to travel to every site and document that culture in a way that can also bring it to people in the sense of realizing, well, with human evolution, this is something we probably went through also, of moving to new environments and figuring out how to live inside of them. And then, and that kind of, the tool use that comes from that and social evolution. And so it's like a lifelong project that I'd be lucky if I could finish. But that's certainly what I want to put my efforts to after I get my PhD.
And, of course, There are a lot of people who really want to study primates. Do you have connections? Do you have a plan? Or is this the kind of thing where you have to take your chances and hope that you get that opportunity?
I have, thankfully, from working within the community, it's one of the small communities, so you end up knowing lots of people. And I do have connections where I could certainly start working in places. But it's a very difficult thing to do because there's some of the smaller sites. It could be a hassle for them to have a photographer there. And so that's also partly why I want to have the science behind me, because then I can offer more in terms of what I'm bringing them. Because it can be, I guess ideally what I was thinking in my head would be I could also raise grants to get money for things like camera traps. And then, so when I'm coming to a site, it's not just me taking photos from the place and doing research. It's giving back to the site in terms of some conservation efforts. If it's helping out with echo guards or camera traps for the science or something, bringing also something else to the site instead of just photography, but other things too.
Well, I can't wait to see what that turns into. Hopefully we get to see some amazing images and really learn a lot from you in the future. Ian, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Ian Nichols is a photographer for National Geographic and a conservationist. He'll be speaking Thursday night in Des Moines at 6 p.m. as part of the Blank Park Zoo's Changemakers Speaker Series. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me now, Margaret Wertheim. She's a well-known science writer. She's director of the Institute for Figuring and serving as a vice chancellor fellow in science communication at the University of Melbourne. But she is most well-known for a project she conceived of with her twin sister, the Crochet Coral Reef Project. And she'll be presenting her lecture, The Poetic Enchantments of Science, next Thursday, February 11th at 5:30 at the Art Building West at the University of Iowa as part of the Creative Matters Lecture Series. And as I mentioned, she is on the line with me now. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Charity. Lovely to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start with the Crochet Coral Reef Project. Tell me when you first conceived of this very unusual idea.
My sister and I were actually sitting around crocheting over Christmas break in 2005, and we were playing with these forms that you can make using a technique called hyperbolic crochet that was discovered by a mathematician, Dr. Diane Tamina. And we started messing around, and we realized that we could make things that looked like coral reefs. So over a few drunken evenings, watching Xena Warrior Princess, we conceived that we could crochet a coral reef and bring some attention to the plight of the fact that coral reefs all over the world, like the Great Barrier Reef, are being devastated by global warming.
All right, so there are so many pieces of that we need to explore, but let's start with hyperbolic math and crocheting. Explain that piece of the puzzle. What are you talking about?
Well, when you see corals and kelps and sea sponges and nudibranchs and lots of reef organisms, they have these frilly, crenellated, sort of curly forms. And it turns out that they're all biological manifestations of a kind of geometry that's known as hyperbolic geometry. And that's an alternative to the geometry we learn about at school, which we call Euclidean geometry. And in Euclidean geometry, everything is nice and flat and just sort of generally seems fairly intuitive and ordered. But it turns out that there's this other kind of geometry called hyperbolic geometry that mathematicians discovered in the 19th century. And it nearly drove them nuts because things like circles and straight line, parallel lines, triangles have different properties on this hyperbolic geometry. And they were a bit blown away and thought, you know, this was some sort of strange absurdity. But it turns out that, in fact, these forms are realized in nature, and nature with corals and kelps and even things like lettuce leaves has been making hyperbolic structures for hundreds of millions of years. But the mathematicians didn't realize that.
So you are playing with this in a crocheting form. Why was that so interesting to you? I mean, before you thought, oh, we can make a coral reef out of this. Why did you want to make it happen with your hands?
Well, one can make these models of hyperbolic geometry just as purely mathematical models, which is what Dr. Taimina discovered in 1997. And she was doing it as a way to have models of these surfaces to use in classes that she was teaching in geometry at Cornell University. So she was doing it purely as a mathematical pedagogical tool. But my sister and I, we started, as it were, going wonky. We didn't stick to the exact mathematical formula that she had invented. And when we kind of went a bit wild, what they started to do was look more natural. And immediately when we had a clump of them there, they sitting on our coffee table, they started to look like a coral reef. And we thought, oh, you know, this is really interesting. We grew up in Queensland, the state of Australia, where the Great Barrier Reef is. Coral reefs are dying out because of global warming and ocean acidification. Wouldn't it be interesting to make an artistic simulation of coral reefs using this beautiful crochet technique, which would give us an opportunity to teach people about mathematics, to teach them about the marine science, to bring attention to global warming, and also collectively do a beautiful art project together. And so we really thought that maybe 20 or 30 other people would be interested in following us down this kind of tangled, twisted, but beautifully synthesizing path. And 10 years later, it's become the biggest art and science project in the world. And we've done it in 35 cities and on a dozen countries in 5 continents all over the world.
So how much of a coral reef did you and your sister crochet before you started trying to get other people involved?
Well, in the beginning, we had crocheted a relatively small amount. You know, it was filling like a couple of coffee tables in our living room. And slowly other people started to get involved. And together with about 20 or 30 other people, we did a couple of early installations that were beautiful. But it's just kept growing and growing over the last 10 years. So what happens now is when we have exhibitions of our work, which has become a lot, it's become very large now itself, we work with the local community. Say there's, we work with one of the early communities. We did it in Chicago. We did it in New York. We did it in London. We've done it in Sydney. And what happens, we work with those communities and teach the local people how to make these hyperbolic surfaces with crochet. Then those people, maybe hundreds, even up to 1,000 people in that city or that region, will make a coral reef of their own. And some of the local reefs get absolutely enormous. So we did it with the Smithsonian a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C., and almost 1,000 people were involved. And the reef that they created was just this vast, vast thing. So these installations can get very, very big. Unfortunately, there isn't one place where they all come together. So we have they get done in the community, and then it's sort of a bit unknown what happens to the reef after the construction of it.
In getting people involved in crocheting a coral reef, we were talking about the mathematics behind it. Do you have to understand the math to be able to crochet a coral reef?
You don't have to understand the math behind it, but everybody who does this comes to understand the math. When I give talks about this, as I've been doing in Iowa next week, I always begin the workshops and begin the whole thing by doing a lecture about the mathematics and explaining the history of hyperbolic geometry and then explaining the history of how Dr. Taimina came to invent hyperbolic crochet. And within the course of talking about the project, we actually do go into the foundations of geometry a great deal and talk about how it also, you know, introduces the kind of mathematics that lies at the heart of general relativity, which is going to tell us about the structure of our universe. So a huge part of the project does become, in fact, people learning a great deal about geometry than they ever imagined they might.
You have talked about the fact that you've been surprised by the overwhelming dominance of women who have volunteered to be part of this project. You expected it to be more women than men, but you didn't expect it to be so many more women than men. Is it primarily, can you give me a percentage on how many women versus men get involved in this project?
Yes, it has surprised us that about 99.99% of the people who have participated in the project, people who've actively made models that have been incorporated into the installations, have been women. And we were very surprised by that. We assumed that there'd be more women than men, but I really thought that it'd probably be like, maybe 70% women, 30% men. And so it's really surprised us that it's broken down so much along traditional gender lines.
That is interesting. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Margaret Wertheim. She is a science writer and many other things, but she's also one of the co-founders of the Crochet Coral Reef Project. She'll be speaking in Iowa City next Thursday, February 11th at 5:30 at Art Building West at the University of Iowa as part of the Creative Matters Lecture Series. Her lecture is called The Poetic Enchantments of Science. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Margaret Wertheim. She's a well-known science writer. She's the director of the Institute for Figuring, and she's also serving as Vice Chancellor Fellow in Science Communication at the University of Melbourne. She's with us on the line from Los Angeles today, and she is best known for a project that she developed with her twin sister. It's the Crochet Coral Reef Project, and she'll be presenting her lecture, The Poetic Enchantments of Science, next Thursday, February 11th at Art Building West at the University of Iowa as part of the Creative Matters Lecture Series, lectures at 5:30. And Margaret, just before the break, we were talking about how extraordinary this project has been, how it's taken off, and there have been coral reefs crocheted in so many cities around the world, art installations, so many individuals getting involved, and 99.99% of them, you said, are women who've gotten involved. And it's interesting to me because, of course, crocheting and handiwork like that is traditionally a female field in many ways, although mathematics, traditionally a male field. And here's an opportunity that brings the two together. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that one of the things that's great about this project is, and we hear it again and again from our participants, is how much they love the fact that here they are doing a traditionally feminine task, a handicraft, that they link with their mothers or their grandmothers, and that at the same time they're learning about mathematics, which is something that many of them, as when they were girls or young women at school, were told, oh, no, darling, you're not very good at math. Don't bother about that, dear. But they are. They're interested in math, and they are being shown through this project that, in fact, they do have mathematical brains. They can understand really complex geometrical conceptions. And I think it's really important to think about this because math, of course, there's nothing innately masculine or male about mathematics. It's a human endeavor. But it has been the case that historically it's been associated with men, and women have been generally discouraged from mathematics. And I think what this project proves is that women are capable of math. They're even interested in math. They want to engage with it if only it's offered to them in ways that are appealing to them.
When people get involved in the project and start crocheting their part of a coral reef, are there patterns that they follow, or do people get to just make up something that looks like part of a coral reef?
Mostly you just learn the basic techniques, which is the very simplest patterns, and then it's a form of open-ended experimentation. So really, you could write out the patterns for every different item that gets made, and there is a huge diversity of crochet coral reef species that have now evolved over the course of the project. But really, people use it in a more playful sense, in that they once you know what you're doing, you just kind of play with your hand and say, what if I want to go out a bit more there? What if I want to go up a bit more here? You have, sometimes you have a conception in your head in advance of, oh, you know, I want it to be this shape, and then you sit down with a bit of paper and you work out, you know, roughly how I'm going to do that. So it really is like a kind of experiment in applied mathematics where people are learning as they go. And really, just as nature has a sort of organic evolution, so this project has organically evolved from very simple things to a much more complex taxonomy of crochet coral creatures.
I'm sure there are people thinking, well, that's really cool. And if you look at the pictures of any of these art installations, I mean, it's incredibly beautiful. But when people get involved, what can you do? What do you do to make sure they're also genuinely learning about coral reefs?
Well, when we have the crochet coral workshops, as I say, I begin by giving a talk about the mathematics and the science and the environmental issues behind the project. And always in the course of the project in any particular city, there will be lectures about this. And in all of the exhibitions, we have texts on the walls that talk about this. So it's like, you know, when you go to a museum, you know, you're looking at objects, but you're reading the texts that explain what it is that you're seeing. And so there is both the pedagogical part of the project and the artistic part of the project. And it's very beautiful in that sense that within the context of learning something, you're also having the opportunity to actively make something aesthetically beautiful yourself.
When people go in and look at the project, if they haven't been involved in making it, mm-hmm. what do you want them to take away from that experience?
Well, really, the crochet reefs are human-made artistic representations of real living reefs. And it's to call, by looking at the beauty of the artistic version, one, we hope that it calls people attention to the fact that the real living reefs are dying out. When we started the project in 2005, there was, you know, occasionally we joked to ourselves, oh, what if the Great Barrier Reef dies out? Then our crochet reef will be something to remember it by. 10 years later, to everybody's horror, there is real talk that major reef systems like the Great Barrier Reef may actually die out in the next, you know, within this century if we don't stop putting so much CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So the project is meant to call attention to what is a serious environmental crisis.
Do you feel like it's working?
Human beings haven't stopped using CO2 to anywhere near a significant enough level. All of the talks from the recent conference in Paris have been very alarmist. So, no, we human beings are nowhere near to curbing our greenhouse gas emissions as much as we should be. And I think that any art project can do is to continue to bring the idea to the forefront of public consciousness and say, people, this is still going on. We need to address this. But no art project in and of itself, of course, can change vast social behaviours. It's like journalism. All we can do as journalists and public communicators is to keep banging on in the public arena how important this is, how the state of these beautiful ecosystems are getting very fragile. I know that being involved in the Reef Project has changed my personal behaviour. Does it change anybody else's personal behaviour? I can't vouch for them, but it's certainly doing a lot to bring the attention to the millions of people who've seen the exhibitions.
I'm talking with Margaret Wertheim. She's one of the co-creators of the Crochet Coral Reef Project. She'll be speaking in Iowa City next Thursday at Art Building West at the University of Iowa as part of the Creative Matters Lecture Series. And in addition to, well, there have been so many different iterations of the Crochet Coral Reef Project, but you have worked to, I guess, in some ways, hone the message, change the message, communicate about the coral reef in different ways. One of the things you did was collect your plastic trash. You ended up collecting your plastic trash for 4 years, but this started as an idea to crochet plastic into a coral reef, right?
Yes. We have a large section of the Crochet Reef Project that's all done in plastic, and we call that the toxic reef. And it's meant to be a comment on the fact that there's this vast amount of plastic that's going into our oceans, and it's particularly intense in this great Pacific gyre of plastic that exists, you know, just near Hawaii. And when we first learned about that, we thought, oh, well, we should do a crochet response. We should make a plastic reef to call attention to that problem as well that's facing marine life. But we didn't want to just do an artistic project. We wanted to do something that, you know, was actually had an impact in our own lives. So we thought, well, the first thing we can do is become aware of how much plastic we used. And we're pretty ecologically sound. We've been really grown up without packaging and thought we were pretty good. But after we'd collected our plastic for a week, we were horrified at how much we had. And after a month, we were appalled. So we just kept going. We ended up collecting and storing our domestic plastic trash for 4 years. And when I say our, that means myself and my twin sister, Christine Wertheim, who do the project with me. So we now have 4 years' worth of our domestic plastic trash, which itself gets exhibited as an artwork. We call it the Midden. And it's really powerful to see. This isn't just random plastic trash. It's what two people who were really being parsimonious with their use managed to use in 2 years. And that's just what we use at home, not taking into account, you know, old computers and stuff at work. And when it's exhibited, I think it's very, very powerful because people are forced to see, well, that's how much trash they generate. In fact, they generate a great deal more because during the course of this project, we became so alarmed that we really tried not to bring, mm-hmm. not to use plastic.
So as you've incorporated that into what you're showing people, you've incorporated that into the coral reef, you've also created a bleached version?
Yes, we have two what we call bleached reefs, which are very beautiful. They're audience favorites, I have to say. They're reefs that are done in white and very pale colors. And the reason for that is that when corals get sick, the sign that they're sick is that they start to go white. And that means that the conditions they're in are stressed, so there's pollutants or the water's too warm or the water's the wrong temperature, and they go white, which means that they're ill. Now, if the conditions return to normal or something more healthy, they will get their colour back and they'll be fine. But if the conditions stay bad, then they will become white permanently, and that means that they're dead. And so now in the Great Barrier Reef or any reef systems, you see vast sections of reef which are now permanently white. And they look like ghost reefs. And so we wanted to make a crochet invocation of this phenomena.
In so many of the major installations of the Crochet Coral Reef Project, the crocheting, a lot of it has been done in kind of a community effort where people actually gather together and work on this project. Is that part of the power of this project, that you're creating community?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, one way of looking at it in that sense is that it's, you know, an extension of the traditional idea of the sewing bee, where women would get together to do something like quilting or embroidery. And in this case, yes, women come together and work on crocheting a coral reef together. And one of the powers of it is that because hundreds of women are involved, hundreds of people, most of them women, are involved in creating these installations, you get something that's much bigger and much more spectacular than any individual could create on their own. And so it is a rare thing in that it's art created by many, many people, and that gives you something that, you know, the whole is a lot more than the sum of its parts. And in that sense, it's also, I'd like to point out that in that sense, the crochet reefs that we make are analogues of living reefs. And there's a very nice environmental message in this, I think. So if you look at something like the Great Barrier Reef, it's made by billions and billions of coral polyps. So each coral polyp is a really small organism, about a centimetre long. And by itself, it can do very little and looks very unspectacular. But when thousands of genetically identical coral polyps get together, they form a head of coral, which can look very beautiful. And when thousands and thousands of heads of coral get together, that's what a reef is. So living reefs are built by the collective action of billions of coral polyps. And I think that's a beautiful metaphor for us humans. It's what, as individuals, we are like coral polyps. Individually, we don't have a lot of power. Individually, we really are very limited. But when we collectively do things and work together in vast numbers, then we can create amazing things. And I think this is a metaphor for how we need to think about solving the problems of global warming and ocean acidification. It is as a collective of billions of humans working together that I believe we can resolve these problems and find a better, more healthier way of living.
You've inspired so many people to pick up their crochet hooks and become part of this project and to learn about coral reefs. Do you feel like there's a next step? Is there a moment for you and your sister to say, okay, put down your crochet hooks and let's do something about this?
Well, when you say let's do something about it, I mean, we are doing something about it. The problem in that we are educating people about this critical issue. I'm not a marine biologist, nor is my sister. We both have other jobs. So, you know, the people who can do, well, marine biologists can do things like carry out specific conservation work. But really the thing that's needed here to do is that every human being on planet Earth, including me and myself and you and everybody listening to this program, the one thing that we all need to do is to change our practices. We all need to cut down the amount of fossil fuels we use. We need to stop being such consumers of plastic. We need to stop being consumers of many things. So I don't ever see a time when what we will be doing with the reef will be fundamentally different, because what is needed is what is happening is the collective raising of awareness about this problem, which is not going to go away, and the collective daily commitment to actually changing our personal practices so that we create a healthier environment.
Margaret, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Margaret Wertheim is a well-known science writer. She's the director of the Institute for Figuring. She's also serving as a vice chancellor fellow in science communication at the University of Melbourne. She lives in Los Angeles, and she and her twin sister together created the Crochet Coral Reef Project, which has spread all over the world. She'll be presenting her lecture, The Poetic Enchantments of Science, next Thursday, February 11th at 5:30 at Art Building West at the University of Iowa as part of the Creative Matters Lecture Series. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Claire Roth, Dennis Reith, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.